Webb, who's doing the Boxmark Black, is doing another show April 15th at Oregon Episcopal School in PDX. And you can visit her site for more info at damarisweb.com or stageandstudio.org. That's it for today's show. Thank you to Janet Anderson, our engineer. And you can hear the show again at stageandstudio.org. Till next time, I'm Dimae Roberts. More music by Parfait Basile.
KABU is a proud sponsor with Runaway Productions of Northwest Hip Hop Fest 4, February 27, 2015 at the Hawthorne Theater, 1507 Southeast 39th Avenue, Portland, Oregon. Bad Habitat, Tope, Speaker Minds, Mike Crenshaw, Kinetic MCs, Glenn Waco, Pale Soul, Flowmatic, Diction, Destro, Gums, Soul Miner, and many more. February 27, 2015 at the Hawthorne Theater. Northwest Hip Hop Fest 4 starts at 9 p.m. and is 21 and up.
Art Focus is next with host Joseph Gallivan. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, From Our Hands to Yours, celebrating 42 years of American arts and crafts. Freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from February 28th through Christmas Eve. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
Have a go, and let it be a gallery, put you all inside my show. Andy Warhol looks a scream.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio Portland. My guest this week is Sonnet Stanfill. She's the curator of Italian Style Fashion since 1945, a show which is currently at the Portland Art Museum through May the 3rd. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Sonnet.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
This show is purely about fashion. You go in, it's mannequins everywhere, beautiful dresses, there's some video, there's some props and accessories, but really you're sort of driven through chronologically to hear the story of Italian fashion or Italian style. And where do you begin with a story like this? You begin 1945 and you have to mention the war.
Yes, we begin in 1945 at the close of the Second World War by showing two outfits from the war. And what's interesting about them is that they help to tell the story of what the Italian government was trying to do during the war, which was to regulate fashion production. I don't think they were particularly successful in doing this, but they attempted to do so by awarding special labels called marks of guarantee to those manufacturers who were producing fashion according to the wartime restrictions on materials and decoration. One of those two little unassuming day suits on show has a mark of guarantee label inside. It's really rare to find these, and so we photographed the label and put it, blown it up size-wise so that the visitor can see it. So what's funny to me is to think about what the fascist government was trying to do there and contrast it with what comes next.
And what does come next? Pretty
well,
spectacular.
It is spectacular. And as the visitor walks through the exhibition, they'll encounter a group of evening gowns that represent this explosion of glamour at the war's end. And this glamorous kind of outpouring was the result of one man's efforts. Mr. Giovanni Battista Giorgini helped to organize the first internationally attended fashion shows in Italy, and the first one took place in 1951 in his house. He accomplished a miracle, which was to not only convince Italian designers from all over Italy to come and show in one place at his home in Florence, but also, crucially, to convince the American buyers and press to come to Italy for the first time to see these shows. And they came, and they spread the word. And within just a couple of seasons, that fashion show had transformed into a gala event over 3 days where not just a handful, but hundreds of buyers and press from all over the world descended.
And who in Italy was buying these dresses and wearing them, and where were they wearing them to in the 50s?
I think that the truth of the matter is that most Italians really could only dream of affording the glamorous gowns that were shown in these catwalk shows. The catwalk shows took place at the Palazzo Pitti Grand House in a room called the Sala Bianca, or the White Hall. And these Sala Bianca fashion shows showcased gowns that were incredibly expensive, and so most Italians couldn't have afforded it, which is why the North American market was crucial to the development of Italian fashion in the post-war period. Americans were affluent, and there were many cities across the U.S. where American women were really hungry for the next fashion excitement. And this excitement was coming from Italy and not Paris.
So Americans were reading about this in Vogue, back when Vogue still had drawings in it?
Yes, Americans were reading about it in fashion magazines. They were reading about it in their local newspapers. A lot of the American press, the LA Times, the New York Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, and Examiner, all sent fashion reporters to these fashion shows. They had photographers take pictures, and those photos ended up in the local press around the U.S. So this was big news. And of course, Americans, because it was a vast and affluent market, they could afford these very glamorous designs.
There's a fabulous dress. It's a sort of bronze-colored evening gown made of silk, and it's cut so that it looks like it's made of feathers.
Mm. Well, that dress was a gown designed by Simonetta, a young woman, a noble woman who had actually been imprisoned for her fascist beliefs during the war. And at the war's end, like many impoverished Italian nobility, she started a fashion business and used her social network as her client base. And this allowed her to start a fashion company, a fashion label. And she was known for these glamorous gowns like the one you've mentioned. It's got a typical 1950s bell-shaped skirt. It's very full. The surface decoration is remarkable with these small pieces of silk cut on the round to look like petals. So it's a very romantic kind of otherworldly creation.
How many of them would have been made, and where do you think they would have ended up?
That gown would have been one of probably only a handful made at the time. And it stayed in Italy, and we were able to borrow it from a private collector. There were a few Italian women who frequented some of these houses, and that particular gown would most likely have been bought by an Italian noblewoman for her wardrobe.
Mm-hmm. As you say, when you say we, you mean the Victoria and Albert Museum.
That's right.
In London.
Absolutely.
And what's your title there?
I'm curator of 20th century and contemporary fashion.
So this show has been in other places.
Well, this show started out in London and then began a three-city American tour, which began with Minneapolis at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts, then traveled here and will next go to the Frist Center in Nashville, Tennessee. And I think that what's wonderful about the Portland connection is that one of our key designers in the exhibition that I've featured is Emilio Pucci. And of course, he was, though Italian, he studied at Reed College.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us then, Pucci, he was at Reed? And then what happened?
Well, Pucci was at Reed, and he studied there and also perfected his skiing technique. And also, that really was the basis of his business when he was first spotted on the slopes.
When was this?
In the 1940s, and he was originally commissioned to make some stylish ski wear. He was spotted skiing with a friend who was wearing his designs. And the next thing you knew, his ski wear was featured on the Sala Bianca catwalk. In the exhibition, we actually have photographs of Pucci designs on the catwalk being modeled by a beautiful young woman, with the buyers and press all enthralled.
So he made the outfit for the Reed ski team.
He did. He made the uniform, the ski team uniform for Reed. That's correct. Yes.
But then he went back and established himself as a designer.
Absolutely.
In Italy.
He was based in Florence and really showcased the best of Italian textiles from his home base in Florence. He commissioned the beautiful silks and the kind of kaleidoscopic prints that we think of when we think of Pucci. Most of those would have been made by the silk manufacturers in Como. And so he was an example of an Italian designer using the best materials available from local sources.
So after the Sala Bianca, there is the wardrobe of one woman, and there's a jacket lying down. It's a dark jacket, but it's just says jacket with red silk lining. So you're just showing off the lining there. And who made that and who owned it?
That jacket was part of the wardrobe of Mrs. Werner Abegg, who was married to a textile manufacturer based in Turin in the north of Italy. And she was a woman who could have afforded the best of French haute couture, but chose instead to buy local. She had her wardrobe made by a dressmaker named Maria Grimaldi, who's kind of a shadowy figure. We don't know much about her. We know her name, but her garments never had a label in them. They just had sometimes a little maker's mark of a group of flowers stitched in.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why we showed that jacket open is that I wanted the visitor to see what it looked like on the inside, because the craftsmanship is as equally stunning and meticulous as it is on the outside. So if the visitor really looks at the seaming and the cut and construction, they'll see how beautifully it's manufactured.
That section turns into what is called Hollywood on the Tiber. So this is Rome as a center of filmmaking and sort of glamour, and the La Dolce Vita sort of symbolizes all that. How did it come across in the States? Did it have an immediate impact, or was it something that arrived later?
I think that moment of Hollywood on the Tiber, which is really a kind of shorthand for all that you've described, that phenomenon of the intersection of film and fashion in Rome, it was a moment where American actresses and actors, American celebrities, simply by virtue of being on location filming in Rome and all their love affairs and the comings and goings from clubs and bars and fashion houses when they went shopping. This was all chronicled in the popular press, and it shone a bright spotlight on the Italian designers that they were wearing and patronizing.
So when you have Audrey Hepburn sitting around in makeup, you know, having something done to her, that image ends up in the paper.
We have photographs of Audrey Hepburn shopping with Salvatore Ferragamo. There's an amazing brooch, a diamond brooch that was bought by Richard Burton for Elizabeth Taylor from Bulgari off of the Via Condotti at their shop in Rome. And so these purchases were almost public knowledge, and it helped to fuel the hunger for Italian fashion across the world and certainly within the United States.
There's actually a lecture on March the 8th by Sean Levy. It's called The Real Dolce Vita. So he'll be talking about the film industry and you know, what was really happening in Rome at that time. What happened to the idea of Rome after that? Did it get dissipated across Italy? How did the north of Italy come to take over as the fashion capital?
The dynamics of what happened next are really interesting, because Florence retained its reputation as the center of the catwalk shows, and Rome also retained its reputation as the center of couture, of the kind of bespoke handmade gowns and tailoring. But really, history was marching on, and the future was in the north, in Milan. And why that's important is that Milan was long the center for textile manufacturing. The north of Italy really was the kind of epicenter of factory-produced textiles. That resulted in it being anointed as the next fashion capital because of the march of time, making ready-to-wear really the clothes that people were going to start to buy.
Ready-to-wear means clothes made with fixed sizes and cheap and kind of changing fashion every few months.
But I would agree with that, except for the word cheap, because, yes, it was less expensive, but clothing made in Italian factories was always to a very high standard. That's the thing that really gave Italy its edge. It was its secret weapon, because the Italians, even in a factory setting, have always been adept at making beautiful clothes. And it's why even designs that have been designed in Paris were probably made in Italy. Most of the French designers produced there. So the Italians really had the secret weapon of the beautiful factory-made garment. And it's why designers like, you know, everyone from Gianni Versace to Giorgio Armani were able to convince the public to accept ready-to-wear as the new fashion language.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio Portland. My guest this week is Sonnet Stanfill. She's the fashion curator at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, and she's here with the show Italian Style Fashion Since 1945, which is at the Portland Art Museum through May the 3rd. Tell us what kind of music you listen to when you get the chance, and do you listen to it while you work?
Well, I don't listen to it while I work, but I do have to say that thanks to my parents, I've been brought up in an opera household. And so when I want to put on a piece of music that I find inspiring or relaxing or to kind of take me out of where I am, I listen to opera. And one of my favorite operas is Mozart, Don Giovanni. The music it's just delightful. And there's one duet in particular, La ci darem la mano, which is a romantic, it's just a romantic, light, entertaining piece of music.
Let's give it a listen. That was La ci darem la mano from Don Giovanni by Mozart. What does that mean?
In English, it means then we will take hands.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think it means then we will join hands. It's a better translation.
This is all before it all goes wrong for Don Giovanni.
Yes, exactly. It's a bit of a cautionary tale, this opera. But that's this kind of moment in the opera. It's a moment of naive optimism in the story.
So we're talking about how Italian fashion changed after the war and how it became a global phenomenon. So there's this room, the Hollywood on the Tiber section turns into the Made in Italy section. So suddenly we're seeing names that, you know, everyone's heard of, Versace and Fendi. What happened then? How did that happen that it blew up?
Well, we really are moving from a fashion system based on the trace of the hand and on the handmade and bespoke to, yes, as you say, to the factory setting. And part of why this happened was that the Italian fashion system was already geared up for manufacture because of the textile industry. The textile industry has long been the backbone, the secret weapon of Italian fashion designers, not just because of the quality, but because of the inventiveness as well. And because of this factory base around Milan, and because of the local press, really the fashion press was located in Milan, all of the fashion magazines and the newspapers, all of that, and the advertising, we have to add, combined, it was a kind of perfect storm, making Milan absolutely ready to promote fashions that were made in multiples.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that Milan explosion was to do with a new type of designer. In Italian, the word is lo stilista, or the stylist, but stylist isn't really quite capture it. It's really somebody who was adept at not just designing the clothes, but also promoting them, him or herself, comfortable also selling them to prospective retail buyers, a kind of polymath who was a jack of all trades. One example of that is somebody named Fiorucci, Elio Fiorucci, and we've got a design of his on show, along with some film showcasing an after-hours party at one of his stores in New York.
So this is an after-hours party in a fashion store, and there's sort of people dancing around, and you know, there's like a punk-looking guy, and there's a guy with his shirt off.
Yeah, they were having a good time in this video, but I think what's great about it is that it captures this phenomenon of boutiques and shops becoming after-hours party centers. And that was all part of a designer creating a buzz around his or her label. And also, next to that video, we've got examples of the Fiorucci shopping bags and trade cards with some fantastic graphic design. Of course, another thing that the Italians were quite good at. And so it all came together in one amazing package, making that brand, the Fiorucci label, a hot, desired item. I don't know if you remember Fiorucci jeans, but in my day, when I was a teenager, they were quite the thing.
And were they a designer item? Were they really expensive?
They weren't expensive. And this was the key, because they were branded, but they were affordable to a wider number of people. And so even though Fiorucci was selling jeans and t-shirts, they were packaged and marketed in such a way that they were really hot commodities. And this kind of... what's the word I'm trying to look for? This dynamic really set the groundwork for people that followed. And I'm thinking about the big names like Giorgio Armani and Gianni Versace. This combination of ready-to-wear clothes, beautifully marketed, labeled, and advertised through great fashion photography, helped to kind of drive Italian fashion into the heartland of the U.S., all across the world.
There are some amazing pieces in cases there. There's a Fendi piece, which is fur, but it's mink.
It is. From a distance, you know, it looks like wool because it's mink, but it's shaved mink.
Shaved mink.
Sort of the ultimate in luxury, because it looks like a very pedestrian fabric. It's very colorful, kind of jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah, it's a multicolored sort of patchwork design.
That's right. But yet, you know, the material, it does look quite normal. But it's shaved mink, which is incredibly expensive. And it's shown alongside the paper pattern, the original sketch, to give people an idea of the design process. Because really, this is a key element for Italian fashion, is this, the idea of craftsmanship infuses the whole exhibition. And so the Fendi fur coat is one example of quality, craftsmanship, and tradition that's been handed down from one generation to the next.
There's a fringe jacket. Leather fringe, and the fringe is all
over it,
all the way down the pants.
That's right, yeah. Love that.
Who's that by?
That's Versace. And it's Versace in his Baroque phase. As the British would say, it's a bit vulgar. But it really has, it captures what Versace was good at, which was working with leather and also embracing bold print. The shirt in that outfit is this kind of Western style, Baroque printed with gold, and also in the back it's got a lot of fringe and beadwork. It's a real tour de force of Versace's work.
This last sort of part of the show, there's a video where you listen to sort of people in the industry talking about Italy, and then there is cases full of accessories, and then there are beautiful photos on the wall. Just tell us, what is the, in the video, what are they trying to tell us in the 6 minutes?
That video was my attempt to try to bring some of the debate about the future of Italian fashion into the four walls of the exhibition.
Oh, you shot the video, right? You You did the interview.
Yes. So I traveled to the offices of all of those protagonists of the industry, to Milan and Rome, and to try to get them to speak about what they think the future holds. Because with China providing a bit of competition for Italian manufacturers, but also at the same time, China and other emerging markets are really the future of consumption for Italian fashion, that there's a lot of discussion happening now about, with factories closing and et cetera, about where Italian future is going and is there a next generation. And so the responses in these in these interviews are quite spicy, some of them. There's criticism of the Italian government, no surprise, and of the high taxes for businesses, and also how closed and the market is to young designers. So this is really my attempt to try to not just celebrate Italian fashion, but also to make sure that the visitor understands that it's a really complex picture right now. So the city of Prato has one of the largest Chinese communities in Europe, and Prato is known for its so-called parallel district of Chinese-owned factories producing garments at a very low cost, often using illegal immigrant labor. At the back of the room are some framed photographs that showcase not just Italian photography, but also Italian advertising. And that's an element that I wanted to highlight because they've really been at the forefront of reimagining what advertising could be like. Mm-hmm. If you look at those Benetton ads, those are actually images that don't have the product in them, mm-hmm. and yet they're selling Benetton clothing. So Benetton, as well as the fashion photographs of someone like Paolo Roversi, beautiful, romantic, almost haunting imagery of Italian fashion on worn by models for the pages of Vogue and other fashion magazines. So really great contributions to our visual culture.
There's a section of local designers, Portland designers, which is put together by the Portland Art Museum. When you're in London and you mention Portland, what was the reaction?
Well, everyone that I told when I was coming to Portland, everyone I mentioned it to said, I'm so jealous. Portland is so cool. Portland's got an amazing arts culture, an amazing food culture. It's also a city of entrepreneurs. And I think those elements link it very much to this exhibition, because this show essentially is about entrepreneurialism. All of the fashion designers that we've showcased in this exhibition were risk takers. They started businesses, you know, off their own backs. They didn't have vast amounts of money. They didn't have big investors. They were taking a risk. And that kind of, you know, that kind of small scale business culture, I think, has great links to what's going on in Portland as well.
So I have to ask you this. When I think of Portland, what people wear on the street, it's like Gore-Tex, fleece, shorts in winter. What do Londoners see?
Well, I think the alternative to that vision is that you go into a store like Nordstrom or Mario's and you see that they're showcasing top designers from all over the world. So you know that even if they're not wearing those clothes in downtown Portland, or, you know, I just went to a Blazers game yesterday and everyone was in jeans and t-shirts, but there are people buying those clothes. There is a sophisticated Portland culture that makes those businesses viable.
Mm-hmm. And there's enough, it seems to be there's enough young designers here who are interested in high fashion and, what would you call it, street fashion.
Yeah.
To
sustain those kind of businesses, yeah.
This show, Italian Style Fashion Since 1945, it actually, as you enter the museum, you see a sort of T-shaped arrangement of fantastic clothes. Now, is that the beginning or the end of the show?
Well, chronologically, it takes place at the end of the show. But what I like about the way that the Portland Art Museum has organized it, it comes at the beginning. It gives the visitor a real taste of what Italian fashion today is all about. It looks at glamorous evening wear and day wear from the 90s to the present, and it captures the moment when Italian designers became, in some cases, more famous than the celebrities that they dressed. So the big names are here, the Dolce Gabbanas, the Miuccia Prada, Gianni Versace, Giorgio Armani, of course, and newcomers like Giambattista Valli and Fausto Puglisi. Marnie, and so on. So these are big names who no longer just design fashion, but also a whole universe of goods from sheets to the interiors of hotels. So these designers are now celebrities in their own right.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio Portland. My guest this week was Sonnet Stanfill. She's the fashion curator at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, and she brought the show Italian Style Fashion Since 1945 to the Portland Art Museum, which runs through May the 3rd. Thank you so much for coming into KBOO today, Sonnet.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Becoming Dr. Ruth, produced by Triangle Theater. Starting February 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Becoming Dr. Ruth tells the story of the outrageous and iconic Dr. Ruth Westheimer and the journey she took from fleeing the Nazis to her struggle as a single mother to coming to America and becoming a renowned sex therapist. Again, that's Becoming Dr. Ruth, produced by Triangle Productions, from February 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Buenas tardes, esto es Tania Gómez Daza para KBOO News. A continuación, un corte en español para el día 24 de febrero de 2015. Pide al gobierno de Estados Unidos al juez federal de Texas, Andrew Hannen, que suspenda el fallo que bloquea las medidas de alivio migratorio para